This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Eric Hansen's new book is set in the Middle East, but it's not about the Gulf War. What brought him to Yemen in 1988 and 89? Well, it's a long story. Here's the short version. 13 years ago, when Hansen was traveling around the world, he was shipwrecked while sailing in the Red Sea. For 2 weeks, he was a castaway on a desert island off the coast of Yemen. He was rescued by smugglers. He buried his possessions for safekeeping, thinking he'd return a few days later to pick them up, but he didn't. The most valuable possession he left behind was the journal of his travels in the 1970s. In 1988, while he was living in New York, he found himself thinking about these journals so often that he decided to go after them. And that's what brought him to Yemen. Eric Hansen's new book, Motoring with Muhammad, is about the search for his journals.
I happened to have 7 years' worth of travel journals with me when I was shipwrecked. And it wasn't until probably 3 or 4 years ago when I started writing professionally that I started daydreaming about what I had left behind on the island. These, they're more than journals. There were short stories. There were interviews with people. And I had written them in sort of very easygoing style. I had no intention of selling any of these stories. But once I did become a professional writer, the value of these lost notebooks gained enormously.
Why was it so hard to get official permission in Yemen to go to the island in which you had buried your journals 10 years before?
Well, the problem with going back to Yemen in 1988 and 1989 to collect the journals was that even though the islands off the coast of Yemen, which are largely uninhabited except for temporary fishermen camps throughout the year, is that the island's guard, the major port, Hodeidah, from the Red Sea, there's the Russian military equipment is offloaded in the same vicinity. The terminus of the Hunt oil pipeline is within 5 miles of the same area. And it's suspected or rumored that on one or more of these islands, there's a PLO training camp. So the islands that I had visited in 1978, which nobody even thought about, in 10 years later, were sort of, very much affected by politics and, military activity.
One of the things that keeps coming across in your book is the way your sense of time was completely changed living in Yemen. Everything seemed to take a lot longer. People would always say, Inshallah.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning what? God willing?
Yeah, Inshallah means God willing. Things will happen when they're supposed to happen. In the United States, I think we're all used to making plans, filling out our week at a glance or day at a glance notebooks, and scheduling our time in advance. In Yemen, as in other parts of the Islamic world, things unfold sort of at a more natural, leisurely rate. There's always time for more discussion, more negotiation, more cups of tea. And I think that it's just a different pace of life. They're not rushing. They're not in a hurry to accomplish, different tasks.
Are there certain sights and smells that you think of as defining your stay in Yemen?
Probably the most distinctive smell is that of ground cumin, coffee, pepper in the marketplaces, the smell of henna, which is a very fine powder, smell of cloves, cardamom, dust in the air, diesel fumes. The thing I like about the Middle East is there are a lot of different smells, and you walk through different parts of the town, and they're just all very evocative of another period in time. I might be walking through the spice market, and then later that day I'll be sitting in a restaurant, and all those spices that I was smelling in sacks are all incorporated with the food. It's a very the sweet smell of tobacco being smoked. It's, I think, visually and almost every other way, all the senses are affected by being in these countries.
You spend a fair amount of time sitting around with other men smoking or chewing quat. What kind of herb is it, and does it give you a high? What is it like?
Well, there's a common misconception about the use of quat, which is it's a leaf. I think it's distantly related to either the pepper, I think the pepper plant. And it was, it's sort of the main socializing drug of Yemen. It's very, it is so mild, it's hard to really describe the effect. It's certainly no stronger than, you know, a few espressos or, you know, a couple of glasses of wine. And in fact, the most valuable quat, which is chewed sort of like chewing tobacco, you put a ball in the side of your mouth and you just keep adding leaves. The most expensive types of quat have the most subtle effects on the chewer. And the idea is not to get completely wasted and out of control. It's sort of to focus your thoughts, to it's to encourage conversation. And almost every single day of the week, they have these quat parties where all the men get together. The women have their own parties. And starting about maybe 1 or 2 in the afternoon until sunset, people will sit around floor on mattresses with bolsters and chew quat, and they will discuss politics, religion, family matters, tribal disputes, water and land disputes. And it's sort of like a town meeting where everybody has to come together as equals. And I found these quat parties incredible. There would be music. Sometimes the men would get up and do tribal dances. It seemed to be a very civilized way of spending every afternoon.
How would you participate since you couldn't speak or understand Arabic?
I would be, most of these parties that I would go to, they're always by invitation. And there were a couple of Westerners there that I became quite good friends with. One of them was a language teacher, and he would take me to all these quat parties, and he would translate most of the conversation for me. And also, there would usually be a few students who spoke a little bit of English.
Can you tell us the story of how you finally got your journals, how you were finally allowed to go back to the island that you had been shipwrecked on 10 years before?
In 1989, I went back to Yemen for the second or third time looking for my journals. And I went to this fishing port, Al-Luhayya, and we hired a fishing boat, a single-engine fishing boat, to take us out to Yukban Island, where the journals had been buried, and the island lies about 20 miles off the coast. And we started off in the morning. There were about five or six of us in the boat. And we got about 6 or 7 miles out to sea, and the engine broke down. Yeah, we started drifting out into the Red Sea. We had no food, no water, no oars, no sails or anything. And so we bobbed around for a few hours and were eventually rescued by a fishing boat that had wandered off course. And I had been escorted by the National Security Police because although I had obtained permission through the Yemen embassy in Washington, D.C. to go back to these islands, nobody could believe that I was actually looking for travel journals. They thought I was looking for buried money or buried weapons, so they watched me very carefully. But later that afternoon, we found another boat, and we went out to the island. And arriving on the island, I was just overwhelmed by this feeling of walking into a daydream. It had been, I think, 11 years since I had left that island with a group of Ethiopian goat smugglers. And, I mean, just the way my heart was pounding, I walked onto the beach, and I just couldn't believe that I had gotten back there. And I spent about 2 hours, I think, hour and a half, 2 hours, digging in the sand. And just before we had to leave before sundown, according to the security police, I did find the journals, and I brought them back to the capital city, and I spent most of the following 10 days just thumbing through a seven-year period of my life that I hadn't forgotten about it, but it just brought back all the details of, you know, wandering around the world. I mean, it was an incredible experience digging them up.
What do they mean to you now? Do they mean everything you wanted them to mean, you expected them to mean?
Well, it's a tie to my past, and I think that people keep journals and diaries to refer back to. And I wonder whether I had had the journals all along, whether they would have meant so much to me, you know, whether I was, you know, working as a writer or not. But I think the fact that they had been lost for so many years, and I thought I would never get them back again, of course, their value increased in my mind. But once I did get them, I read every single page. I indexed them. I, you know, sort of highlighted what I thought would be good short stories, what would be, you know, good characters for fiction. And it really was. It ended up being a treasure chest for me. It's, you know, probably 1,000 pages of journal entries. And I think what the true value of those journals, or the most significant value, was they were written in sort of a very naive fashion. I had no intention of ever using any of this material professionally. And so there's a very nice tone to them. It's very easy to read them. They're entertaining. It's almost as if I'm watching, you know, little video clips of, not my childhood, but when I was a young man, you know, in my mid-20s, up until I was about 30. And
can you just give us a sense of the experiences that are in it, like the travels that you wrote about in there, where you were?
Oh, God, I mean, just all over the world, living living in the Sinai Desert with Bedouins, you know, fishing with them at night, and, oh, man showing me his tattoo, and then pointing out, which was of a constellation that he was born under, and then pointing up into the sky and saying, you know, there, you can see it right there. What are some of the other things? A 900-mile hike I did in the Himalayas in 1976. Traveling through the Golden Triangle, through Laos, Burma, northern Thailand. A lot of the trips I did, this one in the Golden Triangle in particular, I wasn't paying too much attention to exactly where the borders were, and was traveling with people who were involved with smuggling, the opium trade. And visiting Laos in the mid-70s was amazing. Going to Vientiane for the first time.
Do you still travel a lot now?
Well, it's funny. I started writing because I thought that would be a good way that I could keep traveling. But with the publication of my first book, Stranger in the Forest, I realized that I could actually write as well as travel. And since the mid-80s, I have concentrated almost all of my time on writing. It seems to satisfy all the things that I got out of traveling.
Eric Hansen is the author of Motoring with Muhammad. This is Fresh Air.